Hello, good afternoon. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Lisa Falsko. I'm CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council. It's such a pleasure to see everyone today. I'm glad you found us as we move downstairs for this program. Today we have a bread basket donated by Great Harvest Bread Company. So if you haven't had a chance to purchase a raffle ticket and make somebody happy for the holidays, you have about 2 minutes to do so. You can run to the front. If you could please take a moment to turn off your cell phones. Today's program will be recorded for KSKA and will be available for download next week. You can access this program as well as our previous programs on either our website or alaskapublic.org. You simply search for AWAC Presents and you'll find this program. And we'd like to thank William Toyer for doing the recording today. Thank you so much for recording for KSKA. We are a membership organization, so if you currently are not a member, please consider joining the World Affairs Council and supporting our programs. Also, if you're looking for a holiday gift idea, we have World Affairs Council membership gifts that you can give to a friend or a student, and it's all packaged with a nice bow for the holiday season. There's also information on the tables regarding our endowment fund. We have a sponsor, Cornerstone General Contractors, who is now matching through the end of the year, so for the next couple weeks, any donation to the endowment fund up to $2,500 to support future programs for our next generation. So if you've thought of considering to donate to an endowment fund, if you do so before the end of the year, Cornerstone General Contractors will match you dollar for dollar. And is there anyone that this is their first Alaska World Affairs Council? If you wouldn't mind raising your hand. Okay. Wonderful. A lot of new faces. Wonderful. Super. Glad you came. And if you like today's program, our next program, we will be back upstairs January 11th, where we will feature a panel of Alaska service personnel who have just served in Afghanistan, and they'll be here to talk about experiences on the ground. If you're a student, if you wouldn't mind standing and being recognized, do we have any students during finals week who have braved? Oh, congratulations. Hope finals are going well, and it's great to see you all here. And we'd like to thank BP so much for sponsoring our student program and making it possible for them to come to these programs. And speaking of thank yous, I'd also like to thank the World Trade Center and AEDC, who are committed to bringing these type of programs to Alaska. They have partnered with us on this program, as well as BP, Shell, and ConocoPhillips, who supported this program to help with advertising and get the word out. And before I introduce the head table, I'd like to ask Kari to bring up those raffle tickets. While she's doing that, I'll mention at the front desk, she has books of Vic Fisher, one of our speakers who will be coming up at Waterfall for sale, as well as our illustrious speaker today. Out of print books, we have a few left, and he said he would sign them. So if you're interested in a copy, we have some of those for you as well. Ah, he's pulled the winning ticket. Okay, if your number is 567-984, you've won a Great Harvest basket for the holiday. Ah, fantastic, wonderful, congratulations. And now I'd like to introduce the head table. To my far left is Mr. John Bittner from the Anchorage Economic and Development Corporation. And to his right is Mr. Greg Wolf, a former board member of the Alaska World Affairs Council and executive director of World Trade Center Alaska. And to his right, I'd like to bring to the podium Mr. Garrett Wong, who is the chairman of our board. Mr. Garrett Wong.
Well, thank you, Lisa, and thank you, everyone, for joining us this afternoon. You know, it's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Mr. Jack Prokowski. Now, often referred to as Mr. China, Jack is widely recognized as an expert on doing business in China. He's a graduate of Yale and the Harvard School of Business. Jack spent 20 years on Wall Street, rising to the head of the investment bank at Paine Webber. He and his wife, Carlene, have lived in Beijing since 1994. While in China, Jack founded a Simco Technologies, Simcoe Technologies, a major industrial enterprise that he built and ran for 15 years. Jack has twice earned the title of the 10 best employers in China due to Simcoe's reputation for developing local management. He's also the only foreigner to be designated one of 30 outstanding entrepreneurs in China's auto components industry. In 2009, he founded JFP Holdings, a merchant banking firm focused on China. In addition to his business, in 2008, Jack authored Managing the Dragon, How I Am Building a $1 Billion Business in China. His articles on China, its economy, and developing business in the country have been published in sources from the Wall Street Journal, the Huffington Post, and the Far Eastern Economic Review. Jack is a leader of professional organizations, such as the Council of Foreign Relations, and frequently interviewed by news sources such as CNN, Fox News, NPR, and the BBC. He continues to share his experiences at universities, business groups as well, and corporate and industrial conferences. Please help me welcome to the podium Mr. Jack Perkowski.
Thank you very much, Garrett, and good afternoon to everyone. I'm delighted to be here. About 6 months ago, I got an email from Lisa, and she invited me to speak to this group. And I was won over by the fact when she told me that China is now the biggest trading partner for Alaska, and that of the 5 billion or so of exports that are now leaving the state, about a billion and a half go to China. So I thought with that kind of engagement with China, there certainly would be a good audience that would be very interesting in hearing about the country. Because about 5 years ago, I was asked to go on a three-city speaking tour that began in Sydney, Australia, went on to Melbourne, and then ended up in Auckland, New Zealand. And in each of those cities, we spoke to about 500 to 600 government and business leaders. And in each of those cities, we had the same four speakers. And my job was the same in each. I was supposed to lead off and talk about China. Following me was President Bill Clinton. Following President Clinton was Carly Fiorina. And following Carly Fiorina was Michael Eisner. Now, because I went to China in kind of an unusual way, I get called on a lot during the course of a year to speak to groups like this about my experiences and so forth. So because I tend to do it a fair amount, I usually don't get very nervous. But you can bet in the weeks before Sydney, I was getting plenty nervous. Because whatever you think of his politics, Bill Clinton is arguably one of the best communicators of all time. And here I was supposed to lead off for him. My wife, Carlene, has been working with me in every job, or every company I've created over the last 20 years. And she was the head of corporate communications at a Simcoe, where I was then the CEO. And as head of corporate communications, she dealt with the media. And as we were getting closer and closer to Sydney, she could see me getting visibly more and more nervous. So she tried to calm me down. And she said, Jack, she said, the absolute best position to be in is to be speaking right before President Clinton, because all the media are going to want to be in their seats to hear the beginning of his talk. That just made me more nervous. That meant that not only would those 600 people be in the audience, but all the media would be there as well. So before I got up in front of that group at 9 o'clock in Sydney on the Monday morning, I had to think of some way to break the ice. So I told them, I said that before I was born, my parents fought long and hard about what to call me, and they gave me the name Jack. I said, when I went to China, the very first thing the Chinese did was give me a Chinese name. I said, I've been in Australia now for only 2 days, and I find that I have a new first name. Who is? Because for 2 days, people are looking at the agenda and say, well, I know who President Clinton is, I know who Carly Fiorina is, I know who Michael Eisner is, but who is Jack Perkowski? So I thought what I'd do this afternoon is do what I did in Sydney and just tell you a little bit about myself. Now, Garrett gave you some of the details, but let me kind of flesh out some of those. I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and then I went on to Yale University. In addition to what I did in the classroom, I played on one of the best Yale football teams of all time. My junior year, we were ranked 16th in the country. For those of you who remember, I blocked for a guy named Calvin Hill, who went on to be drafted number one by the Cowboys. Our final game against Harvard my junior year was called by Sports Illustrated one of the five most memorable college football games of all time. In fact, it was so memorable, they made a documentary about it in 2008. The title is Harvard Beats Yale 29-29. There's a whole story behind that title, which we don't have time to go into today, and I prefer not to go into. But the documentary starred the players. And so about 20 to 30 players were interviewed to talk about the game and going to school at that time. And I was interviewed. Tommy Lee Jones was interviewed. He was a guard for Harvard. He was rooming with Al Gore. Our tackle roomed with President Bush. And our fullback was dating Meryl Streep. She was going to Vassar at the time. So we had a pretty interesting collection of people at Yale and Harvard in those years. I then went on to the Harvard Business School and graduated in 1973, and then went to work on Wall Street for Payne Webber. And I basically then, for the next 20 years, did just about every type of investment banking transaction you could imagine. IPOs, M&A, private placements, I ran a real estate group, and then I ended up running investment banking. So in 1990, I had a pretty full first career, about 20 years on Wall Street. But I decided I wanted to do something completely different for my next career. And I decided I wanted to identify a trend, hopefully a long-term trend, that I could get out in front of. And that got me interested in Asia. And as I started doing my research, I came to the conclusion that Asia would be one of the key stories of the 21st century. So I made my first trip to Southeast Asia in the fall of 1990, spent about 6 weeks, mostly in Hong Kong, a little bit in Taiwan, a little bit in Korea. And frankly, what I saw happening on the ground then confirmed everything that I'd been reading about. So I then made a whole series of trips to Asia in 1991. At the end of 1991, picked up and moved to Hong Kong. And at the end of 1991, I found myself in Hong Kong in the middle of Asia. And the very first decision I had to make is, where do you focus? Because I didn't quite realize, because, you know, like many Americans who kind of came to their careers in this pre-globalization period, you could do your entire career in the United States, never have to leave the country because the market is so big. And so when I got on that United Airlines flight in Chicago and that little airplane went past Anchorage to Asia, my eyes glazed over, because to me, Asia was just one big region. But when you get there, you realize that Asia is a big region with many different countries, all with different governments, different ways of doing business. So unless you're going to try to be an expert on all of them, which I would argue is pretty near impossible, you need to pick one or two to focus on. Today it's easy, it's China. But back then it wasn't so clear. In fact, most people that looked like me weren't going anywhere near China because they felt it was way too early. However, I talked to a group of people called the Overseas Chinese Businessmen. And all of them, the people I talked to, were running very big, built very big businesses in Hong Kong. And every one of my conversations with those businessmen began and ended the same way. They would spend 5 minutes talking about their very big business in Hong Kong and 25 talking about what they were trying to do in China. So I felt that if the smartest, most knowledgeable people in the region were going to China, then that's what I should do. So I made my first trip to China in September of 92 and really haven't left since. As I kind of started traveling around the country and understanding what was going on, the first thing that hit me was the fact that China's a big country. I knew that there were a lot of people, but frankly, I didn't realize that almost to the square kilometer, China is the same size as the United States. And the reason that's important is that that meant that every industry in China was fragmented. And companies, rather than doing business nationally, were doing business locally. So thinking back on what had happened in the United States as the telecommunications and transportation infrastructure improved, I felt that as that happened in China, these industries would start to consolidate, and companies that were doing business locally would start doing business nationally. So the conclusion I took from that was that rather than investing in individual companies, that what I should do is pick an industry and then develop a strategy for creating a leading company in that industry. That, of course, begged the question of which industry. I picked automotive, not because I had any experience in automotive, because I didn't. And when many people hear that I picked automotive, they say, geez, Jack, of all the things you could have picked, why automotive? And that's a reasonable question, because the automotive business can be a very tough business, particularly in a mature automotive market like the United States. But when you come to countries like China, and China's already the second largest economy with $7.3 trillion GDP, even though it's a big country, it's in a much different stage of economic development. So while an industry might be difficult in a mature market, it might have a lot of other characteristics in an emerging market like China. At the time I got interested in the automotive business, China was doing about 500,000 vehicles a year. And as I thought what was happening, I felt that given China's size, that as the economy continued to grow, that China would need more highways, trucks, buses, and passenger cars, because that's really the only logical way to move people and goods around a country, or around a country the size of China. So I became a big believer that one day China would have a large automotive industry. I don't know whether you realize it or not, but this year China will make about 20 million vehicles. China is by far the largest vehicle market in the world. The projection for 2015 is 25 million. The projection for 2020 is about 30 to 40 million. To put it in perspective, every year there are only 75 million vehicles made in the entire world. So by 2020, China could be accounting for 30 to 40% of the entire production and consumption of vehicles. That's what I mean about a market like China can operate very differently than one like the United States. So I became a big believer in the industry. Now, others also saw the same thing. Volkswagen had two joint ventures in China at the time. And they knew that they couldn't make good quality vehicles unless they had good quality suppliers. So they began talking to all of their suppliers, trying to convince them to come to China. Had very few takers. For most companies, it was way too early. So they were frustrated. The Chinese government was frustrated, because they wanted to build a large auto industry, and they understood the same thing that Volkswagen understood. You need a good supplier. So in 1994, they passed a policy that said that foreign investors in components could have majority ownership. Now, there are a lot of businesses in China today. You can own 100%, you can own majority. But back then, this is the only one that I know of. And that was important, because the other clear trend that I saw was that every year that was going by, China was becoming more and more integrated into the global economy. So that meant that it wasn't enough to build a good Chinese company or good company in China. We had to build a company that was globally competitive. And that meant that whatever I found on the ground in terms of people and factories were going to have to change. And I needed the ability to do that. So that's why majority was important. So in January of 1993, Asimco Technologies, the company I'll describe in a minute, was three people, me and two people I'd recruited. And I set out to create a leading components company in the country. In the first 9 months of 1993, the three of us visited over 100 factories in 40 cities all over China. You name the city or province, we were there. During that 9 months, I ate every part of every animal, with the emphasis on every. And it's a mixed audience, so I'm not going to answer any more questions about that. Also in China, they have this drink called Baijiu, which looks like water, but tastes and smells like kerosene. And it's very strong, and they drink a lot of it. And at that time, and certainly different today, there was very little capital in China. So here was this Wall Street guy that is now in China and may bring capital to our factory or our city. So they wanted to show us a good time. So for 9 months, we visited two factories a day. And the schedule every day was the same. We'd get up in the morning, get in a van, go visit the factory, get the factory presentation, get the factory tour, then they invite us to lunch. A lot of food and a lot of baijiu. We then get in a van, go to the second factory, get the factory presentation, factory tour, they invite us to dinner. A lot of food, a lot of baijiu. Now, for 9 months, I had the equivalent of two New Year's Eve celebrations every day. And I know our friends here at the university students are thinking, wow, that sounds like fun. Believe me, after about a week or two, it gets old. And after about 9 months, I figured I better go back and get some real capital before my liver goes out. So I went back to my colleagues on Wall Street, and in the Christmas holidays over the Christmas holidays in 1993, I raised a little over $100 million to found our company. I then went back to China in February of 1994 and founded and began building Asimco Technologies, and did that for the next 15 years. Now, just to give you a little idea what Asimco is, Asimco's is about $500 million in sales U.S. now, has about a dozen companies, operating units in 8 different provinces throughout China, 12,000 employees. If you go to China and you see a truck or a bus, it's running on a diesel engine, chances are that 20 to 25% of the parts for that diesel engine could come from an Asimco factory. So Asimco makes blocks and heads, piston rings, camshafts, fuel systems, starters and alternators, compressors, all the key components that go into that engine. There's no Chinese company, there's no foreign invested company that has such an important share of such a key market in China. Garrett mentioned that we are twice named one of the 10 best employers in China. We pioneered the development of local management. These were surveys that were done by Hewitt Associates and the Wall Street Journal. I'm also proud of the fact that in 2008, China Auto News, and Garrett mentioned this, named me one of the 30 outstanding entrepreneurs in China's auto industry. Not just for 1 year, by the way, but for the whole 30 years of economic reform. I was the only foreigner on that list. Now, the reason I kind of emphasize that is not because I want to impress you, but I hope you're at least a little impressed. My 92-year-old mother in Pittsburgh was very impressed, and she's a hard marker. But the reason I mention that is because what it told me is that the China press and the China auto industry considered Asimco, even though it was founded by an American and funded with Western capital, that they considered Asimco a Chinese company. And so what I tell companies when they come over that if they want to be successful in China, they ultimately have to make their operation in China a Chinese company. We can talk more about how you do that. I left all my management positions in 2009. We sold the company to Bain Capital in 2010. If you haven't heard of Bain before this year, I'm sure you know more about it than you ever want to know. And I founded a company called JFP Holdings. And quite simply, I'm going back to what I did in the 70s and 80s on Wall Street. We're essentially helping Western companies bring their products, services, technology into China. We help them figure out their strategy. We help them to implement it. We're now working with a number of those companies to get capital in China for their China operation. That would have been impossible 5 years ago. But the big story is China's capital markets are developing. There's more and more capital in the country that's willing to invest in those kinds of projects. We're also working with many Chinese companies as they look to expand abroad, raise capital, do M&A, and so forth. So that's what I'm doing now. As Garrett mentioned, my wife and I live in Beijing, and we've been there since 1994. Now, at our apartment in Beijing, we get CNBC, so we like to watch Squawk Box. And I've got we've got a farm in New Jersey, which we come back to 4 times a year, and we like to watch Squawk Box at the farm. But when we watch Squawk Box at the farm, we have a cup of coffee. When we're in Beijing, we have a glass of wine because it's 13 hours later. But that's how we get our information about how people are looking at China. And I can't tell you how many times when we're listening to people talk about China, I turn to Carlene and I say, are they talking about the same country that we live in? Because often the misperceptions about China are really very, very astounding when you consider how prominent China is today. So let me just talk about a few things. Let me talk about the economy for a minute. The big story over the last couple of years is China's growth is slowing. Absolutely right, no question. 10.4% growth in 2010, 9.2% in 2011. This year it'll be somewhere between 7.5% to 8%. Everybody understands that. What most people don't understand are 3 important factors about the Chinese economy. First of all, this slowdown has been self-induced and manufactured by the government. Secondly, China can, if they felt the need or feel the need to re-stimulate, they have a lot of tools to do that. And third, the Chinese economy is already in a fundamental transition. And let me just spend a minute on each one of those. You know, like all countries, in the aftermath of the global financial crisis, China put in a stimulus program. And in October of 2008, they put about $60 billion into a stimulus program to basically try to get the economy past the effects of the global financial crisis. And it worked. China's growth bottomed at 6.8% in the fourth quarter of 2008. And then in the beginning of 2009, it started to pick up again. But to ensure it, they also, in the beginning of 2009, opened up the credit spigots and told the banks to start lending. So the combination of that fiscal policy and monetary policy got China past the global crisis. However, there were two negative effects to that. The first was it touched off speculation in housing. And you've all read about the tremendous price increases in housing in Beijing and Shanghai. And China, the leadership felt that was, you know, that could be destabilizing. The second thing is it sowed the seeds for inflation. And inflation is a very serious issue in China. If you think about China's 1.3 billion population, at a GDP of 7.3 trillion, the average per capita income is $5,400. However, China has 500 million farmers. Agriculture accounts for 10% of GDP. So if you do the math, the per capita income for those 500 million farmers is only $1,400 a year. China also has 250 million migrant workers. These are people that live in the rural areas and go into Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, and build all the buildings and the infrastructure. Their average income is about $1,200 per year. So of that 1.3 billion people, you basically have 750 million whose average per capita income is about $1,400. The rest of the population, the 550 million, has a per capita income of $11,000, a big disparity in income. And the reason why China gets concerned about inflation is that two-thirds of inflation in China is food-related. And obviously, the biggest part of the budget for those 750 million people is food. So China gets very concerned when inflation goes up because they know it's going to hit the part of the population that they least want to have impacted. So in May of 2010, China took a number of measures. First, they told the banks to stop lending, and they started raising interest rates, and they started allocating credit. Secondly, they slowed down the growth in infrastructure spending. Between 2005 2011, China, the infrastructure spending was growing at 22% per year. Last year, it grew by 10%. So they've pulled back on the infrastructure spending. Third is they put housing restrictions in. In 43 cities across China, they put in a whole series of restrictions, all of which were designed to try to curb the demand for housing. So for example, if you were not a resident of Beijing, you could no longer buy an apartment in Beijing. So that's just an example of some of the things they put in. Okay, so China in May of 2010 started to try to really slow down the economy because of the inflation and the speculation. The other factor is they knew that given the size of China's economy, that it was not sustainable to grow at 10, 11% per year. And they wanted to bring it down to a level of 7 to 8. So the point of all this is this slowdown is not related to exports necessarily. It's not related to anything else you might hear about. This has all been manufactured by the government to you know, consciously bring the growth of the economy down. China, at any point in time, if they think they've gone too far, they can re-stimulate. They can raise interest rates. They can loosen credit. They still have credit restrictions on the banks. The benchmark interest rate in China is 6%, one of the highest in the world. So they have room to lower rates. They can remove those administrative measures on housing. They still have them in effect. And they can also step up the infrastructure spending if they want to. Their total debt, central government, local government, is about 38% of GDP. So they have a lot of room to do that. The third point I want to make is that China is now, the economy is under a fundamental transformation from being one that is driven by exports, government spending, and heavy industry, to one that's depending more on domestic consumption, services, high value-added manufacturing, okay? And so, you know, China's already making that transition. So when you hear people talking about or questioning whether they can, they're already making it, and it's already underway. Let me just give you an example of what that means for the future. And I'll talk about five areas that I think are gonna particularly benefit. You know, this new leadership, came in place, about a month or so ago. So they're now in for 10 years. So what's the next 10 years gonna look like? First of all, there's absolutely no question that China is the biggest consumption story in the world. It's estimated over the next 10 years that 36% of the total global growth in consumer spending will be accounted for by China. So if you're in a consumer products business and you don't, you know, you're not in China, you better get there, because that's going to be by far the biggest market. And just consider this. I mean, China's per capita income is 5,400. Even though its economy ranks second, China ranks 91st in the world in terms of per capita income. It's less than 10% of that of the United States. Yet, despite that, China's now the largest consumer of automobiles. Let me give you another industry that you may not be aware of. Every year, there are 2 million weddings in the United States. The parents of the bride spend $60 billion for those weddings. In China, every year, there are 10 million weddings. The parents spend $60 billion. So China's wedding market today is exactly the same size as the United States. As that per capita income goes up, what do you think is going to happen to the wedding market? That's why we're working with a company called Berks & Myers, which is the Tiffany's of Canada. And they want us to help them take them to China, find a partner, bring capital, and so forth. They want to put 50 stores across the country. Now, in one sense, they're a little bit late. Cartier, Tiffany, Harry Winston, Bulgari, they're all there already. But despite everything that's happened to date, China's still in its early stages of development, so they're still early. Next big one, technology. Any company that has any kind of technology that has any uniqueness to it that can be used in the China market, take it. Take it to China, because it'll get implemented very, very quickly. Environment, big, big area. I was asked today whether the pollution and the air pollution in Beijing is as bad as it's been. It's certainly not getting a whole lot better. But in addition to air, water. You know, China has 20% of the population, the world's population, 6% of the water. 90% of their groundwater is polluted. So in the 12th five-year plan, China's going to be spending $500 billion to clean up its water supply. So if you've got technology out there that can help do that, believe me, China's going to be your biggest market. Healthcare. One of the last big industries where China's opening it up to foreign investment, foreign technology. This is everything from drugs to devices to clinics to hospital management. Let me give you an example. The infertility rate in China is higher than it is in most other countries because of the pollution. There's an estimated 10 million couples in China that need access to the kind of techniques that can help the woman to conceive. Yet there are less than 100 fertility clinics in China. And up until very recently, they had to be owned and operated by state-owned hospitals. China's now opening that up to individuals. So we know one of the doctors that's in that field that wants to get a license and then open up a chain, okay? Fourth, agriculture. China has 500 million farmers. Over the next number of years, 260 million of them are going to move into the cities. So that's going to continue this whole urbanization trend. It also means that there are going to be half as many farmers. That means that China's productivity in agriculture has to go up. That's why John Deere is building a $240 million facility in the north of China to make all of the agricultural equipment. Finally, capital markets. You know, basically, China, you know, U.S. has about 7,000 banks. China has about 3,500. Most of them are owned by the state in some way. They have a very difficult time lending to private companies and small and medium enterprises. Yet those are the very organizations that tend to drive growth in any economy. So the way it's worked in the past is as these various entrepreneurs have made money, or they made money in real estate, they would start lending money to their friends in the city. They lend them at high rates, but if you've already tapped out your family and friends, you're going to take that money because you can grow your business. Up until very recently, that was illegal in China. You could get shot for doing that. It's called underground finance. Despite the fact that there were such severe penalties, it's a $750 billion industry. And so what China did earlier this year is Wen Jiabao, the premier of China, basically said that their banks are too big to lend. And so what they're now doing is they're now giving out individual licenses to individuals to basically let them set up microfinance companies so they can lend to these companies legally. And then the idea is they'll get a banking license in a couple years. So those are kind of five areas. And I just wanted to give you a flavor for what's happening in the economy and how fundamentally it's already changing. If you want to invest in China, it's very difficult to do that. Unless you're a qualified foreign institution, you can't really buy shares in Shanghai or Shenzhen. Yet there are 250 companies, Chinese companies, who have listed shares in the United States. They're traded on NASDAQ. They're traded on the New York Stock Exchange. When they first came to the United States, they sold at a premium because of the China factor. Then because of the global crisis, the premium disappeared. And then over the last couple years, there have been some well-known accounting scandals, Longtop, Sinoforest, and so forth. And so now those 250 companies are radioactive. No investor wants to go near them. And they're selling at 2x earnings, a lot of times a discount to cash. Many of them have very good business models, managements, and so forth. And I'm on the board of one of them, a company called Fushi Copperweld. And so I've seen this, you know, from right in the middle. And I know that of those 250 companies, there are still, you know, there's still probably a few accounting scandals yet to be uncovered. But I know that many of those companies are really good companies. And so we're now putting together a program, and I left this at the front desk for anybody that wants it. It's a little description of this Great Wall Fund that we've just started. We're just really launching it this week. And basically what we're doing, we've teamed up with a money manager in the United States. So they're going to bring the professional portfolio experience or, you know, management experience. And then with our team in China that knows how to evaluate managements, evaluate companies, we can now give investors the comfort that any companies that we invest in are ones that we feel are good companies. I see they're selling the, or they're, you know, selling or giving the book away. I'm sorry it's out of print. It is downloadable. It's on a Kindle. I also do a blog called www.managingthedragon.com. I try to write one or two articles about China every week, so if you're interested in kind of keeping up with what at least I'm thinking about China, I'd urge you to log on. And any of you that are interested in doing business in China, we'd love to talk to you. So with that, I'll just throw it open to questions.
Well, Jack, I'm sure your presentation and comments are going to stimulate a number of questions, and we're going to ask that if you do have questions for Jack, that you wait until Carrie gets to you with the microphone so that we can record this for later on broadcast. And before I give the mic back to Jack, I want to again remind you that this is a membership-driven organization. We do need your membership, so if you're not a member, please give it some consideration. Back at the back table, we've got membership forms and that help bring these kinds of perspectives here to our community. And just a real quick reminder that on January 11th, we've got the Afghan soldiers coming in for a presentation. So please, if you're wanting to join us on that, RSVP on the website. And Jack, just as a small token of your trip here to remember us, here's a gift that you can take home to your farm in New Jersey and then carry it back to China with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So Jack, come on back.
So who's gonna pick?
So Carrie's got.
Carrie's gonna. Oh, Carrie's doing it. Okay.
So first of all, wanted to thank you very much for a very interesting discussion. By way of disclosure, I'm Paul Dunscombe. I'm a professor of East Asian history, so I know that you have to take a chunk of Asia if you're going to make it work. And was also the founding director of our Confucius Institute. In hearing you talk about China, one of the first things that I'm very much impressed by is the way in which you did this in a very deliberate way. You founded a company, you decided which industry you wanted to be in, but before you actually bothered to raise money, you spent 9 months on the circuit, which clearly indicates that you've got an appreciation for the fact that business in China is not just business. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. And in your new enterprise, you're talking about bringing foreign capital into China, but also Chinese capital out. And I wonder if you could talk about some of the challenges that you foresee in that regard. Thanks.
Okay. Well, you know, good questions, and kind of brings up a question or that people often ask me, because you know, I talk about the fact that I raised a certain amount of money in a certain period of time, and I know there's people here that are looking at making their careers in China. They're probably thinking, how am I going to get capital for that? So people always ask me, how do you raise capital for a business in China? And the point you make is a very good one. I mean, first of all, I'd been on Wall Street for 20 years, and so I was kind of a known entity. I mean, most people didn't have to go very far to find somebody that knew me, and so I had a bit of a reputation. And plus, I'd been raising capital for 20 years, so I had experience. But the second point, and the one that you made, is important, because before I talked to the first investor, I really went and I'd spent 2 years basically doing the fundamental research. And that meant not only kind of learning about China, but it also meant identifying the industry, talking to the companies, and really making sure that I could execute that strategy. And so when I actually went out to raise capital, that was all there. The third thing we did is we were very focused. At that time, there were a number of funds that were being put together, and they were going to invest in anything. So the thing was, we're going to raise $100 million. We're not sure what we're going to invest in. but you know, China's growing, so you make money. And a lot of investors like that. We went with a very targeted approach. We're going to raise X amount of money. We're only going to invest in components. We're going to take majority in everything. And so it's very specific, you know, specific. Now, some people didn't like that because they thought it was too focused. They wanted diversity. But there are other people that did like it. And so, and then the third thing is we got lucky. And that's an important thing about any of you who think about raising capital. I don't care whether you're raising $100 or $100 million. You have to be a little bit lucky. Frankly, if we had started capital raising 6 months later, I'm not sure I'd be able to do it. Because, you know, China was kind of in that expansion period from 1991 to 94, but then that inflation peaked at 21.9% in 95. And Zhu Rongji, who was the then economic czar, really slammed on the credit brakes. So if we had been trying to raise capital in that period, probably wouldn't have been successful. So those are kind of some of the comments. Now, when I started that, I didn't know anything about China, I didn't know anything about the auto industry. When I started my new business, my oldest daughter, you know, kids can be very brutally honest, and she's, you know, kind of summing up my prospects for my new business, JFP Holding. She said, "Well, Dad, at least you know something about China now and something about the industry." Because I've had 20 years experience in each. But, you know, we're working with a lot of Chinese companies that want to come to the United States. And there's definitely a very strong interest in doing that. For the reason that they want to get access to technology. Every company in China today wants to move up the technology scale, wants to make higher value-added products. And they know that while they could develop that technology over time, that now they have an opportunity to go abroad and maybe acquire a company or do some kind of a joint venture or whatever. And so they're very interested in coming to countries you know, like the United States, because the United States has a lot of technology. The challenges are that the Chinese entrepreneurs, the Chinese businessmen know what they know and know what they don't know. They know how to run a business in China. They have no idea how to run a business in the United States. And just as difficult as it is for a U.S. company to go to China, it's as difficult for the Chinese to go the other way. And at least in the case of the U.S. companies going to China, there are a lot of companies that they can learn from. See, in China, this is all new. So I think that they need to get comfortable, and that's a big, and that's what we try to do. You know, we kind of act as a bridge. With respect to the United States, you know, the U.S. from a political point of view hasn't really been, you know, the receptivity to Chinese investment in the U.S. has been very mixed. A lot of the cities, a lot of the states want it, but then other political figures kind of resist it because they cite security concerns and everything. And so that's a big challenge, at least with respect to the United States, for a Chinese company to do it in a way that doesn't get, you know, doesn't provoke a political reaction.
Thank you very much for a very informative talk. And you give a very rosy picture of China, and I'm ready to invest. However, in my experience in dealing with China, there's a wild card. And that
there's
is
a what?
There's a wild card.
Yeah.
And that is Guangxi, corruption, which you haven't mentioned. To what extent have you experienced this, and to what extent do you think it influences investments in China and people's view of investments in China?
Well, there certainly is corruption in China, so you know, I'm not going to tell you that there isn't. In fact, one of the big initiatives for the new leadership, and they've publicly said this, is they want to really work hard to try to bring that down and try to reduce it and try to control it, okay? So it is a big issue. And what I tell people is, that, look, there are two ways you could do business in China. You can play the corruption game. If you want to try to get opportunities or deals or whatever by paying somebody or whatever, you can do that. I wouldn't recommend it. It's not a very healthy way to grow a business. But if you want to do it the right way, then you can do that too. And so I honestly, in my 20 years in China and building a SIMCO and doing all the things that we did, I can look my 92-year-old mother in the eye and basically say that I've never done anything that I'd be ashamed to tell her. And that's the way we've done our business. We just let it be known that what we brought was capital. We brought management improved management to these companies. We brought technology. In every one of the cities where we were located, we were probably the best employer in that city. And the local governments appreciated that. And so they welcomed us, and they were willing to do things for us, you know, really not because we were doing anything under the table, but because we were good for their city. And I know it may sound a little Pollyannish, but believe me, that's the way it can work in China. And by the way, I plead guilty to being optimistic on China, okay? I am optimistic. You can't be there 20 years and go through what I've gone through and not be optimistic. It doesn't mean that I agree with everything or that I don't think anything's wrong. There's a lot of things wrong with China. And there are going to be a lot of bumps in the road, and there are a lot of big issues out there that I'm sure all of you can think of at least two or three. However, I don't see anything out there. There are going to be ups and downs as we go forward, but I don't see anything out there that's a showstopper, that all of a sudden it's going to turn China back and that China's going to end up like Japan at the end of the 1980s. And so I plead guilty to being optimistic about China, but I do have some good reasons for that belief.
Another retired professor.
Another what?
Retired professor, in my case, retired. Like a lot of Americans, I've been sort of slightly envious at watching these growth rates. You know, 5 is low, 9 is high. For the last more than a decade, we've watched this enormous growth rate while we've been struggling along in the United States with 2% being a good year. And I'm wondering if you have any observations on the differences between, is it that we're doing things wrong or they're doing things right? You mentioned the cliff that Japan went over, and there's another comparable cliff in a way, historically speaking, in the Soviet Union, which the CIA told us was growing and growing and growing, and then it collapsed, maybe from an overinvestment in industry. So I wonder if you have any forecasts. It's sort of a double-edged question there, but what lessons should we be learning from China?
Well, there are a couple points. One is, I told you I'm optimistic about China. I'm also optimistic about the United States. And the fundamental reason is because I spent 20 years on Wall Street and I see what the capital markets are in the U.S. And yes, every once in a while they go off, they get unhinged a little bit like we did in the financial crisis. But the United States by far has the deepest, most efficient capital markets in the world. And it does a good job of getting capital to companies and people that can best use it and taking capital away from those that can't. And that's kind of what enables the United States to reinvent itself. So I just wanted to make that point because, I'm not in China because I'm negative on the United States. I'm in China because I'm positive on China, but I'm also positive on the United States. And I think that these two countries really have a lot of important things to do together in the years ahead. If you look at China's growth, there are a couple things that are different. First of all, like other Asian countries, and about half the world's population lives in Asia, and the average age is in the low 20s. And so the reason why Asian economies, including China, have a fundamentally high growth rate is because they got very large young populations that are spending money. So that's kind of point one. Point two, the government has really, and that's why I became a believer in China. When I first went to China and I understood what the government was doing, and believe me, you don't have to agree with everything the Chinese government says or does, and I certainly don't. But when it comes to running an economy, I said, boy, they know what they're doing. And the number one thing that they've done is they invested in infrastructure. And that infrastructure did two things. One is it, in the absence of this consumer market that we now have in China, it provided the stimulus for the economy to develop, okay? But as importantly, it improved productivity enormously. One of the first factories joint ventures we did was in Hunan province, and just above Guangzhou. And to get to that factory in 1993, we used to fly to Changsha. It was a 2.5-hour flight. Then we get on a 2-lane road. On a good day, it was an 8-hour trip. It was a 2-lane highway. It ran from Guangzhou up to Beijing. On the south, there were trucks carrying pigs and ducks. And going north, there were trucks carrying manufactured goods. And if none of those trucks broke down, it took us 8 hours. God forbid if one of them broke down, because there's no place to put them. So you had to wait till it got fixed. So it'd take 12 hours, okay? Now, as we're making that trip, the driver would at some point, over in the distance, we'd look and there are people working. And he would explain that they were building a highway. And when that highway was completed, that trip would now be 2.5 hours. But sure enough, a year later, the highway's in. We fly to Changsha, 2.5 hours. The last time I went there, I flew to Changsha. It was still a 2.5 hour flight. Took a 10-minute taxi ride. I got on a high-speed train, and 35 minutes later, I'm in our factory. Now, just think about in my time in China, 20 years, which is a long time in one sense, but not a long time in another. Just in that 20 years, imagine the productivity increases that you get from taking a trip from 8 hours to 2.5 hours to 40 minutes. And see, that's been happening all over China. The other factor is that you do have this big agricultural population. China's now about 50-50 in terms of urban population and rural population. But when they started all this in 1978, it was about 80% rural and 20% urban. You get tremendous productivity increases when you when somebody leaves the farm and goes to work in a city in a job that is backed by capital. Just by that virtual, you know, just by that transfer into a city, into a factory that's backed by capital technology, you get a tremendous productivity. So those are some of the fundamental things that that China is going in its favor. The other observation is that every decision, you know, China, you know, can use fiscal policy, monetary policy, and they can do administrative measures. Every one of those decisions is made for purely economic reasons. That's why China can change its monetary policy. It can change its fiscal policy on a dime, because the people that are making those decisions only have one concern. Does this help the economy grow, or doesn't it? And unfortunately, in the United States, and I'm not, you know, again, this is just a fact of life, I mean, sure, you know, the Fed can do monetary policy. But when it comes to fiscal policy, I think we all know that that's a political decision, not an economic decision. So I see that as being a big, big difference. And like I said, when I got to China, one of the reasons why I became kind of a believer was that, like I said, you don't have to agree with everything the Chinese government does, but when it comes to building an economy, you have to give them an A. I mean, they've managed this country through some pretty tough periods, and they've managed to do it right. Does that mean they're going to continue to get it right? No, there are no guarantees, but if you look at the track record, you have to be confident, or at least give them the benefit of the doubt.
Hello, thanks for coming and speaking about China. I'm a political science student, an English student at UA, and I kind of have two questions for you, if that's okay.
Yeah.
The first one is, I know there's over 300 million basketball players in China, so how would you raise capital in the sports fashion industry?
300
million basketball players in China?
Basketball players. I've never heard that statistic. Yeah. That's a good one. Thank you. I'm going to use that. So there are 300 million basketball players.
Yeah, people that's interested in basketball in China. So how would one raise capital in the sports fashion industry? And my other question is, I'm from Sudan, and I'm aware that China owns 60% of the Sudanese economy before it split. So how would one make the Sudan, to lessen the grip on the Sudanese economy, because I want to go back into Sudan and have us be majority of our own economy. Would you have any advice on that?
As far as the 300 million basketball players, and how do you raise capital? I mean, if there's, believe it or not, there are 10,000 Chinese private equity firms now. 10,000. This doesn't count Blackstone, KKR, international companies. So there are 10,000 Chinese private equity firms. If you've got a good business proposition for some portion of those 300 million basketball players, and it makes sense, and you know you've got people now. See, in years past, you'd have to go to an international firm that maybe didn't know much about China, and so you'd have to educate them about why sports is important in China and why there's an audience and all that. See, today you don't have to do that. You can go to Chinese PE firms that basically understand China, and so if what you say makes sense and you do your homework and you put together a good business plan, my guess is you're going to find somebody that's going to be interested in that. And there's a big interest in all areas and in a lot of these media-related areas. People always ask me, if you can do this all over again, where would you go? And I say China, because I think the story's still playing out in China. They say, no, you can't go to China. Where else besides China? I'd say Africa. And one of the big reasons for that is because of what China's doing in Africa. I mean, China basically has been investing, billions of dollars in 49 of the 54 African countries. They spread it around to all the countries. They're clearly doing it for their own reasons. They want to get access to natural resources, and Africa is rich with those. But they're doing it, you know, they're investing in infrastructure just like they did in China. They're setting up special economic zones in Africa just like and funding them just like they did in China. The big state-owned companies are going in there and building infrastructure, but also I think there's something like 2,000 or 2,200 Chinese companies doing over 4,000 projects. So the big state-owned companies go in and then the Chinese private companies follow. So basically what China's doing is China's taking all the things that it used to build its economy, and they're now working with the various African governments to do the same thing. So I think that the opportunities in Africa, I think, are very good in all the different countries, because now they got a very important economic ally in China. So that would be my comment on Sudan.
Hey, good afternoon. During this last election cycle, there was a lot of discussion on the moving of manufacturing jobs overseas. And if we take the premise that globalization is here to stay, and there's no way that U.S. manufacturing can compete with Chinese labor, in your experience, what do you think is a practical outlook for the future of U.S. manufacturing?
Well, first of all, like in the late 1990s, when a lot of companies were coming over to China to basically try to source from China, okay, there's a big trend. You know, people fell into two camps then. One camp said that all the manufacturing is going to move from the United States to China. The other camp said none of the manufacturing is going to move because of all the issues. Now, neither camp was right. I wasn't in either one. When I founded Asimco, it wasn't to create an export company. We founded Asimco for the simple reason that we wanted to take advantage of the China market. And to me, that's the most important reason to be in China, not because you can lower your production cost, but because you can take advantage of the China market. Now, so of that 500 million or so of sales, 85% was sold in China. We did some exports, and I developed the export business, not because I wanted another market, but I saw selling to Caterpillar, Bosch, Cummins, and those companies as a way to improve the quality and the management at our factories, because these companies do a great job of helping to develop their suppliers. Okay. Basically what's happening in China today is that labor costs are going up, as you might suspect, because per capita incomes are going up. China also, at the end of 2007, put in a new labor law. So rather than negotiating with individual unions, different unions with individual companies, China did it for all of the workers. And they passed a new labor law, which effectively outlined kind of the conditions under which people would work in factories, whether they were Chinese, joint ventures, didn't make any difference, okay? And that had the effect of raising costs, okay? So those costs have gone up. And people have talked about, well, that's gonna, so that's kind of changed the equation. I would also say that the China's productivity is going up. So the point is that yes, the conditions are changing in China. The days of low-cost labor, China interested in making products that rely on a lot of cheap labor, those days are gone. China doesn't want to do that anymore. They want to get away from businesses that rely on a big supply of low-cost labor. They want to move up the scale technologically. The other factor is that you have transportation issues. It costs a lot of money to ship parts from China to the United States. And with fuel costs going up, that's only getting more expensive. And then in terms of the United States, you've got this whole gas situation, which could really, is kind of a game changer. It could really change overnight the competitiveness of U.S. factories, because now that's a source of low-cost fuel. So the point I'm making is the world never stays the same. It always changes. And the world's very complicated. And so I think you just need to be very clear about why you're going to China, why you're there. And if it is just to export back, that game has probably changed. But if it's to be there for the China market, then that's still very much in play.
Thank you very much. I thought it was very interesting what you said about infrastructure being built up in China. And The United States has been building up infrastructure. It just happens to be in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right.
So hopefully that will change. But what my question to you is, I have a patent pending on a motorcycle tool. I've met with Greg about that. And
on motorcycles?
A motorcycle tool. As a motorcyclist for the last 46 years, I've developed a product. And, you know, I've contacted some manufacturers here, and I'm meeting with some manufacturers down in Oregon over the holidays. What would you say would be the caution that one would have going to China? You know, I've heard of patents being stolen and, you know, them doing it just a little bit differently and getting away with it. So that's my question. What are the cautions of doing business there?
You know, intellectual property rights, protection of intellectual property rights is always the big issue. And I don't mean to minimize it. It's an issue you need to think about. However, depending on the product, I don't know what your product is, depending on the product, you can get, you know, get it in China, and you can make it in China. You can do it in a way that protects your intellectual property. It's not going to be 100% protection, but you can do a lot to reduce the impact. The second thing is that China is innovating more. Last year, I think, was the first year where patents filed from China was more than patents filed from the United States and Japan. Now, some of those patents were filed by U.S. companies in China, okay? But nonetheless, innovation is on the increase in China. And clearly, as Chinese have their own patents now and their own intellectual property to protect, the whole attitude towards that is changing. So again, things never quite stay the same. But to me, the most important fact is if your product is so good, and it has whatever it does, if it achieves, you know, whatever functions they are, and you don't get it in China, whether or not you have it in China or not, and if that's needed in China, I guarantee you, before long, somebody in China is going to figure it out, right? Because if you're selling that product into China, maybe exporting it, it's got transportation costs, it's got an export duty, so you got a nice high price umbrella, right? So if that product really is needed in the China market, somebody's going to figure it out. They're going to buy one of your products and they're going to do whatever, okay? So it doesn't protect you not being there. So I always argue to people the best protection for your product is to go to China, manufacture it, get it at a price that's affordable for the China market, make yourself the leader in the China market, and kind of foreclose the opportunity for other companies to take that market share. So those are kind of my comments on IPR. I don't mean to minimize the issue. It's a big issue. But, you know, in all the years that I've been in China, we particularly in manufactured products, we've been able to really work around those.
Hi, my name is Max Bullock. I'm a business management student at UA. I'm very interested in doing business with China, and I appreciate you telling us about the opportunities like technology, the healthcare field, the environmental pollution fixing. And I was wondering about the current opportunities, whether there's doors that are open for us as young entrepreneurs or students, or ways that we can get a connection to get in with this business that, you know, any suggestions for us?
About how to do business in China?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's a good question. A lot of people ask me that. So I have two answers. And I start off, I say, well, you know, one way to do it is to build up an expertise and, you know, stay in the United States, build up an expertise, something that you're good at. You know, I spent 20 years on Wall Street. So when I went to China, even though I didn't know anything about the country, you know, I had 20 years experience raising capital and doing that. And so I had a value add, okay? Now, when I talk to young people like yourself, a lot of times they cut me off in mid-sentence. They say, no, I don't want to wait 20 years. I want to go now. I say, okay, if you want to go now. The only way to do it is buy a plane ticket, get the cheapest one you can, you know, do whatever you can to get a little nest egg so you can support yourself for 6 months or a year. And believe me, you can live cheaply in Beijing. And buy yourself the cheapest ticket you can, get over there, and start studying the language. And what will happen, and I would advise you, by the way, to go to Beijing, not Shanghai. And the reason for that is I happen to like Beijing. But the reason for that is in Shanghai, they have the Shanghai dialect. So a lot of people speak Shanghainese, okay? Whereas in Beijing, it's all traditional Mandarin, right? Am I right? There you go. So I don't mean anything bad about Shanghai. I love Shanghai. But no, in terms of learning the language, Beijing is a better place because of that. But you just need to go there and you need to be there, because you'll never get a job in China from the United States. You have to be there. And if you enroll in those language programs, what you end up doing is meeting a lot of people and things come up. And I can't tell you what it's going to be, but something will come up, I guarantee you, in that 6 months, you know, in 6 or 9 months. But yeah, you need to kind of make the commitment to just go there and kind of live there and start learning the language and that sort of thing.
Hello. From a macro perspective, how do you think over the next 25 years demographic shifts are going to affect the Chinese economy as far as, I mean, it's a very young population now with a steeper cutoff and there's a lot of urbanization. As the population ages over the next generation, how do you see that affecting China?
It's obviously, China has the one-child policy, so that basically means that, you know, you're kind of gradually moving from a condition where each child has six adults supporting them to a condition where you can have one child supporting six adults, okay? So that's a pretty dramatic change. I haven't done enough work on that to know exactly when that happens. I don't think I have to worry about it in my lifetime for that to be a real issue. And I think in terms of the workforce and so forth, I think the big thing that will happen over the next number of years is that the productivity of China workers will continue to increase. And there's no reason why it shouldn't. It's done in the United States, done it everywhere else. They're doing all the same techniques and so forth. So as the productivity increases, obviously you don't need as many workers. So I don't think that's going to be as big an issue because, again, China's trying to get away from those kinds of things. Yes, it's going to change things, but I don't see that as in my lifetime really, and I don't expect dying anytime soon either. So I don't see in my lifetime that being a major disruptive influence.
Hi, my name is Demetrius Alexiadis. I'm an econ and political science major at UAA. So my question has to do with sort of his point. With the growth of Chinese middle class and the increase of urbanization in China, what do you have to say about communism and its influence on both China's economic opportunities for its citizens and for its role in the global economy?
Well, first of all, it's kind of hard to paint China with the brush of communism. I mean, China, since Deng Xiaoping, it's a communist party, but it's not communist. It's capitalist, period, the end. And Deng Xiaoping really took a very pragmatic approach to developing China. And when he was questioned about setting up these special economic zones and everything, about how does that square with the communist political doctrine, he said, I don't care whether the cat's white or black as long as it catches the mouse. So he was basically looking at what works economically, and the first thing that he did was introduce the profit incentive into agriculture, and then he extended that to industry. So to me, China, yes, is a communist party. I mean, I don't think anybody really could tell you what the political doctrine is for communism. China's run today like a capitalistic country. It just happens to be one where you don't have elections. And you've got kind of a leadership, which it's different. It's not Singapore. It's not, it's different. It's not the United States. It's different, but it seems to work. And the Chinese people, are quite happy to outsource the job of running the country to the Communist Party as long as they keep the growth coming. And if they fail doing that, then they got a problem. And so far, so good.
Thank you, Mr. Prakowski, for coming and joining us here in Alaska. My name is Ricardo. I'm a business student at University of Alaska Anchorage. You speak of infrastructure and how it's established this boom in economic growth amongst China. But we know that's pretty much like a economic principle amongst economists is infrastructure, a good solid base of infrastructure. You talk about China very passionately, and I'm sure a lot of Alaskans here are just as passionate about the state of Alaska and our own infrastructure. So my question for you is, what can we do to adopt and learn from certain principles that China has established among their own infrastructure, since we're on the verge of establishing Kibata and certain programs and opportunities here that will allow us to expand in the area of Alaska?
Well, I think, clearly infrastructure is important. So that's the number one lesson. And China's used that to good advantage. Now, the problem is that there is a fundamental difference in cost. And when I drive to my farm in New Jersey and they're repairing a highway. And you have to keep in mind that all the infrastructure in the United States was built in the 50s and 60s, okay? And that was quite, you know, far-seeing at the time, and it did a lot to really have it come, but it's now 30, 40, 50 years old, okay? And so when I drive out to my farm in New Jersey and I see the work crews, I just start adding up the cost. I say, oh, my God. Because I know what those Caterpillar bulldozers cost. I know what they're paying the workers. And so the disadvantage the United States has is the fact that it's a much more developed economy, costs are much higher. And so to build the infrastructure in the United States is a fundamentally different proposition than doing it in China. So I don't know how you bridge that, but I think probably the number one thing is you need to be very, very selective about where you spend your money. And they better be not just somebody's idea of a good thing to do, but something that really makes economic sense. So that would be infrastructure is important, absolutely no question. But I think that given the differences in cost, I think you need to be particularly selective here because it is expensive.
Thank you for the talk. One quick question. What's your perspective on the currency manipulation issue in terms of Chinese companies joining the global economy and vice versa?
About the currency manipulation issue, and I didn't get the last part.
And how that's going to affect the capacity of Chinese companies to join the global economy and vice versa?
Oh, Chinese companies are ready to join the global economy. Yeah, look, I mean, China manages its currency. I'm not going to tell you they don't. It doesn't freely float. But the United States manages its currency, too. I mean, it's basically flooding the world now with dollars, okay? And that's another way of managing a currency. They're basically bringing that, they're lowering the value of the dollar by doing that. So, yes, China manages the currency. But what they've done is they wanted to keep the currency stable. And so it's been relatively stable over the years. And I think most businessmen will tell you, I don't really care what the relative values are. Just kind of try to keep it relatively stable. Because if it's relatively stable, then I can plan. I can make my decisions about what plants I build, where I sell my products, how I price my products, and so forth. So, you know, China, for most of the time that I've been in China, was 8.3-1. You know, being in 2005, you know, they started to basically, strengthen, you know, let the currency strengthen. It's now gone up about 20-30%, so it's now about 6.3-1. But it's been relatively stable during that whole period. And I think the stability is kind of more important than the overall level. And keep in mind that today, you can't just send money out of China. As an individual, you can only send out about $30,000. So what if tomorrow we woke up and read the headlines in the Wall Street Journal that said that the Chinese government said that any individual, any company in China is free to invest their RMB anywhere, or, you know, send their money anywhere? How much money would leave China? So I'm not sure anybody can tell you what the right exchange rate is, because what you have right now is an artificial situation where it's difficult to get money out, and you got a lot of money coming in from foreign direct investment, exports, and so forth. So it's a pretty complicated issue, and I don't think it suffices to say, oh, they're a currency manipulator, and therefore this, that, and the other thing. It's a lot more complicated than that. Okay.
Well, on behalf of the World Affairs Council Board, Jack, thanks for making that trip all the way from China to New Jersey and back up to Alaska. So Merry Christmas to you. And for the rest of the audience, thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you on January 11th in the new year.
Folks. I have to learn to talk fast.